Thank you, Leslie. Have you heard enough? Have you heard enough? I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. I want to introduce tonight's speaker, Sherry Lynn. Come on up. Let's do this.
Not get a mouthful here. Hi, I'm Sherry Lynn. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sherry.
And by the grace of a power greater than me and a lot of the actions I've been taking, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since August 4th, 2004. I would like to thank John B. for asking me to be of love and service to Alcoholics Anonymous, inviting me to speak here in front of you all tonight. Just to let you know, I do have a sponsor. I call her about 5 days a week just to stay accountable, keep accountable. Shit comes up. I gotta talk to somebody about it. And if I stuff it, it's not good for me. So I keep accountable with my sponsor. She has a sponsor. I sponsor other women. And I've discovered that for me, my primary purpose in life is just to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I get more fulfillment from that than anything else in my life. There's not an outside issue that gives me any more joy and fulfillment than working with others. And I wish that on you. If you're not sponsoring, sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, get one. It worked for me. Thousands and thousands of others like me. It's part of the formula, right? It's the basis of the Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to congratulate all the token takers and welcome to anyone who's new. Whether you identified yourself as new or not, doesn't really matter. I hope you stay. I hope you find what I found here, and that is a way to meet calamity with serenity, a way to be happy, joyous, and free, no matter what the circumstances are. I found that to be the easier, softer way. This recovery is way easier and softer than what I was doing before I got here. And I'm grateful the Big Book gives me the formula for the outline for tonight's talk. We share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So with that, I'm gonna start with what it was like. My relationship with alcohol actually started with my mom's relationship with alcohol. She would drink every night after she'd get home from work, and she was the kind of mom who, you know, didn't do my laundry and didn't make me dinner and didn't take me places that I needed to go. She was unpredictable, she was angry, and she was unkind. She would say unkind things. And that was my first relationship with alcohol. When I got to the full ripe age of 13, I arrived. I had my first drink of alcohol at 13. And tell you a little bit about that. I was a salad girl at a camp. It was a camp that celebrated Jewish holidays. And so they had kosher wine. And at 13, I was riding my bike to the camp and working. And so I stole a gallon of kosher wine and under my coat, and I'm holding my bike, and I ride it to my friend Mary's house. And Mary's parents were going out to dinner, and it was out on a farm, so we knew they had a long drive, right? So we were going to drink this wine, and then her brothers came up with some beer and whatnot. And I don't think it took me very long to black out. The last thing I remember was Supertramp playing on the stereo. Remember records, CDs, the actual vinyl things. That's all I remember. Till the next morning, I woke up naked on the living room wood floor with just a sheet. And I'm 13, and there's brothers, and there's a father. I mean, it's like, that was my pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And needless to say, her parents were not going to let me hang out with Mary anymore. One thing I did, though, during that evening, I really enjoyed myself from like the first couple of drinks. I could finally feel like somebody, like I was enough, like I was pretty, like I was okay, like smart enough and funny enough. And you, I thought you actually liked me, right? Like I had all these perceptions that were altered by that alcohol. I loved the effects produced by alcohol. Just that short time that I remember before I got blacked out. And I thought, you know what? I like that. I'm going to do that again. And it was right from the get-go, manage and control, manage and enjoy. How do I do that? How do I plan carefully so that I can have a good time and not have a consequence like that again? I wondered, does that make me an alcoholic? No, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. Between the time that I had my first drink and the age of 16, where I was planning and trying to get as much joy out of alcohol as I possibly could, I decided it was a good idea to run away with the drug dealer who beat me. Of course, I didn't know he was going to beat me until after I ran away with him, right? So we're out of state. And luckily, by the grace of God, I was found about 3 weeks later and returned to my father, who was not an alcoholic, who was not sitting in his bed with a bottle of Gallo wine. And, you know, I started a life in a new place. But I was still who I was. It didn't really matter. I took me with me, and I tried to find people who drank, and I tried to drink like they drink. Had a couple of more pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing experiences. And then I went to college. And in college, I had my first DUI. So I was at a friend's house. There was a bunch of people there, and one of their daughters was bouncing on the couch and she fell and hit her face on the coffee table. So we were all going to go to the hospital. I never made it. I blacked out in the car and I woke up the following day at noon. Never saw my car again. I was walking home from the courthouse. I didn't know what had happened. I had glass in my face, but I had papers in my hand. And the papers are what told me what happened. So I had literally blacked out through the entire experience, and I went to court, didn't even know what happened. Needless to say, I didn't have a driver's license after that. Does that make me an alcoholic? At the time, I didn't think so. That's for sure. And I did have still that need to chase that high that I had, that feeling, that sense of ease and comfort that comes when we have a couple of drinks. I continue to chase that. Lots of bad decisions. I started a series of lying and cheating and stealing and manipulation and risky behavior. At the age of 21, I decided it was necessary to marry a guy I just met. So I met and married a man in 6 weeks. I found out after I married him that he was abusive and that he was not going to allow me to drink. Go figure. He was not going to allow me to drink. I stayed in that marriage 13 years. So I didn't have a drink for a lot of years. But I didn't need a drink because I was in too much fear. And if you took this security away from me, what would be left? I was afraid to be on my own. It's kind of like that. I can't live without alcohol, and I can't live with alcohol. I couldn't live with this man, but I couldn't live without this man. And I decided on the man, so I stayed in the relationship. You don't have to do that with alcohol. It's much better without it. I've been there. At 35 then, I get out of this relationship, and or 34, whatever, I get out of this relationship, and I hadn't had a drink, but boy, oh boy, was I free. So I got started. I got busy. I drank and drank, and my blackouts kicked right in. And I had to figure out how to manage and control better again. I had three kids under the age of 15 at home. And I had to figure out how to be a mom, how to be a worker, because I hadn't been working. I didn't have any friends because I had been isolated. So I had to learn to become a part of society as well. But alcohol is all I really wanted. I just wanted to drink. I was kind of a binge drinker, though, because I didn't want anybody to see me, right? So I made up good reasons to get out of the house so I could drink, and I left my children with irresponsible people. I beat my daughter in a blackout. I was drunk for many, many events and occasions. For example, my one son was going to homecoming, and, you know, you're supposed to go to the parents' party and take pictures, and I arrived very late for the parents' party and drunk because it was my graduation, too. I graduated from college that day, and I went right to the bar and got drunk at 11 a.m., and I was drunk until, you know, I had to leave at 5:30 or 6 or 6:30, whenever it was, that I was already an hour late. Another example, I was taking my kid to look at colleges, and he couldn't find me. I was in the bar in Madison, Wisconsin. That's where I come from. In the middle of the day, just drinking. Like, I'm there to be with him. And here I am, isolating and drinking all by myself in a random bar. Because I had to. Because I was looking for that sense of ease and comfort, and I was uncomfortable all the time. I was driven by fear. I was driven by fear, pretty much fear of pride. Pride and fear. Ego, pride, fear. And I made a lot of bad decisions, and excuse me. That was like as soon as my relationship with my abusive husband was over and he was gone, and that was like the kickoff to the 9-year ramp up to my sobriety date, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I wasn't a good person. I was lying and cheating and skimping on my time at work. And oh, poor me. I was in so much self-pity all the time. If you were me in my life, and, you know, I'm poor and my daughter's cutting and my son is in a gang and the other one's dealing drugs in front of the house. Oh, poor me. I was always asking God, like, it's not like I didn't believe in a God. I would be outside crying to my God, oh, can't you make the kids better? I can't deal with this anymore. And, you know, so God says, okay, well, I'll take the first one, the oldest one, and make him go live with your dad. Oh, can you make him go live with his dad? You know, it's like nothing was okay. Nothing. There was no sense of ease and comfort without alcohol in any part of my life. But it was a gift. Like, I couldn't see it as a gift, but it was a gift that my son was torn from me to go live with his dad. All of it led to that day. That day was a Wednesday. It's just a Wednesday. I decided, on Wednesday, I was going to do another lie and leave work early and drink. And so I went to the bar that was in between my job and my house, and my daughter was 13 at the time, and I called her and I said, oh, I have to work really late. I have to give some presentation at second shift and la, la, la. So I tell her I'm going to be home at 7:30. 7:30 rolls around, I'm not home. 8:30 rolls around, I'm not home. 9:30 rolls around, I'm still at that bar trying to get people to buy me margaritas. A margarita was my last drink. And when I do get home, she's standing at the kitchen sink, and she's like I said, she's 13, she's looking at me, and she goes, Mom, you're drunk. Like, of course, why would I be drunk? I'm at work, right? And that's what I told her. And I said, no, I'm not. You're grounded. Like, the insanity, right? So the look on her face was the same look of the way I felt. I had become my mom. Unpredictable, angry, unreliable, and unkind. Slurring, saying mean things to her. Like, oh my God, I'm my mom. That was my bottom. I mean, I didn't have, you know, dramatic bottoms that some people have. It was simply that look, and I didn't go to rehab. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous because my mom, she said she was an alcoholic. And she was sober 13 years before she passed away. So I took her big book out, and I started reading the stories in the back of the book. Sobbing and sobbing and crying and telling my daughter how sorry I am. And, you know, all the self-pity, all the pride, all the, oh, my God, what will people think of me? I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to drink because it was the only thing that got me out of myself. That was a Wednesday. I went to a meeting on the following Sunday, but I didn't go in. Instead, I took my mom's big book and I went to the beach and I read at the beach. This was in Wisconsin, by the way, so. I didn't go in, and I had an agonizing week of, you know, hating myself and dreading being an alcoholic and dreading not drinking. And what will life be like? There'll be no more Super Bowl parties. There'll be no more weddings. It'll just no fun. No fun. That's what I thought, because I had spent the last 30 years trying to figure out how I could have some fun, just some fun with alcohol, without consequences. But there was always consequences, from the subtle consequences of my children scolding me again to the major consequences where I got another DUI. Right, it's just, there was always consequences. But like the jaywalker in the big book, there were times I got away with it. I didn't get hurt, came out unscathed. I got away with it. But I had bottles hidden in the garage and bottles under the sink and bottles in my bedroom. And, you know, I had a lot to get rid of that week that I got sober. So I went to the meeting the next Sunday, and I heard like my story, and it was the weirdest thing, because it was some lady talking about how she couldn't go to the same liquor store twice in a week because they might think she's an alcoholic. I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm doing. Like, it was totally what I was doing. And, you know, what lie was she going to tell, and what time could she drink, and could she put some in her coffee at work? And, you know, it's like, wow. Like, and I'm just crying and crying and crying at the meeting. It was just all full of self-pity. All full of, oh, poor me. And a lady walked up to me after the meeting, and she said, what's your name? I mean, she said, I'm Catherine. She said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And, of course, I'm like, what? No. She said, I'll be your sponsor. And I'm like, oh, God. But I didn't really know what that was. And I'm like, okay. And I gave her my number, and it's like, what was I thinking, right? But I gave her my number, and she suggested that I meet her at Denny's next Saturday. And here, I want you to go to all these meetings. And we had a little book, an actual book, in Wisconsin that we circled the meetings. And she said, I'll see you there. Now, this is a woman who was 6'3" tall. And she was younger than my oldest son. She had never drank legally. She had been sober for 2 years. And she's still sober today. She's now an attorney. And for the first 5 years, I fought so hard to follow her suggestions because she's fucking my kid. Like, why would I do what you, what do you know? Like, you don't know anything. Like, why would I do that? Call me every day for 30 days. And it's like, why? Well, because I'm just suggesting, you said you were willing to go to any lengths. It took me 90 days to get 30 days in a row, consecutive. And she kept saying, well, it's okay, we can start over. It's like, no, I don't want to start over. Like, why am I doing this? I kept asking her, why am I doing this? Now, remember, I'm talking to someone who's 22 years younger than me, right? Why am I doing this? We'll talk about that when you're done. I'm like, she was so mature. Like, so she knew stuff that I should have known at 13. Like, I didn't know how to cope with this, and I didn't know how to cope with that. And she said, well, what if we look at it this way? And it's like, but she was younger than my oldest kid, so I was really struggling with relating to her. And yet, if I just had enough humility, if I just suited up and showed up and put aside my closed-mindedness, right? She kept suggesting I be honest, open-minded, and willing. And she goes, keep an open mind. She just would keep an open mind. And she just kept making these suggestions. I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, I don't think so. Not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And she said, well, I suggest you do it. And I said, well, how about if I go to this one, this one, this one, and this one? I'll go to 4 or 5 meetings a week. I suggest you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I did not do that. I suggest you go to this meeting, this meeting, this meeting. Nope, not going to that one because those two are both late meetings and I get up early. I suggest you go to those meetings. I didn't go to the one, but I went to all the rest. But I didn't go to the 90 meetings, but I still managed to stay sober. By the grace of God, I'm sure. And then she would make other suggestions like, you could be the greeter. It's like, oh, what does that mean? She goes, just get here early. And so I get there late, right? And she'd say, and you were supposed to greet tonight. I said, yeah, but there was a train. And she goes, you know there's a train every Tuesday at 6:10. Couldn't you leave 10 minutes earlier? And it's like, oh, I never thought of that. Like, oh, like the simplest stuff. And, you know, I greeted, I made cakes, I picked up other people, I made birthday calls. I don't know if people around here do that, but we had actual phone lists, and they were handed out. She handed me a phone list. I want you to get one from every meeting, and I want you to make phone calls. When I check them every morning, see who's got a birthday, make a call. I'm like, I don't know these people. And she goes, that's okay. I'm like, well, what do I say? And she said, you say happy birthday. Like, I mean, it was so much work, but it was simple, right? It was simple. And I didn't want to do it, and I found myself doing it anyway. It was so weird. Like, the first year, I got sober, and August 4th, the next year, I did my fifth step with her on the beach. Same beach I had read the book a year earlier, right? So I did my fifth step on the beach with her and had a date, because you can't date in your first year. But I had a date that night, and she's like, so who are you going with? And I said, oh, I'm going out with Tim. And she goes, he's married. Leave him alone. I'm like, no, he's separate. No, he's married. Leave him alone. No, I didn't leave him alone. You know, I was at my fifth step. It took me another, 2 years to get through the rest of my steps. I was dating Tim. And there's a distraction. I know why we don't date in our first year, because we can't stay focused. We can't put AA above everything else. And this was still my second year, and I'm still having a hard time putting God in AA before anything else. So anyway, I that didn't last. Huh? I got a much better man now, by the grace of God and sobriety. So let's see. So what was it like in the first year? So I'm emotional. I'm a prey to misery and depression. I can't seem to make a living. Like, I was working at a foundry for $7 and some odd cents an hour, made it all the way up to $14.50 an hour. I thought I had arrived. I just couldn't be useful to anybody. Like, without AA, there was nothing else I was being useful to in my life. I wasn't a good mom. I was erratic. I was trying, though, right? In my first year of sobriety, I was trying. I was going to those meetings, and she suggested I meet 3 new women at every meeting, and it's like, I met one. Like, I met one. I was all proud of myself, and I was like, we actually became friends. Like, I had a friend. Like, remember I told you I didn't have any friends? I had a friend who would call me, like, outside of meetings. Like, somebody liked me. And I didn't know what that was like, and I didn't know what to bring to the relationship. I had to learn all this, because before that, everything's transactional. My natural state is to want you to give me something. If I'm going to do something, you got to give me something back, whether it's applause, recognition, approval, some money. I don't care what it is, but you're giving me something. And those kinds of relationships were toxic. That's all I had before I met this one girl. And then, like, I never hung out with my sponsor because she was 22 years younger than me, and I just had nothing in common that way. Purely AA, which is cool because it took that whole thing away of, oh, we need to be the same age and, oh, we have to have the same experience. She kept telling me, age doesn't matter in AA. It just doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how long you've been sober. It doesn't matter how old we are. It's the disease. It's simply a disease. And, you know, if you're new, I hope you stick around, and I don't want you to have to deal with the allergy any longer. But for me, I'm not sharing a lot of Drunkalog because for me it was really the mental obsession. It was really the disease centers in my mind. And as soon as I read that with my sponsor in the Big Book, it was like, oh, that's it. And then I had to learn about the disease, right? There it is. So I spent, of course, time looking at my motives in early sobriety and, well, why do you want to do that? Like, I'd tell her, well, I want to do this. And she'd say, but why do you want to do that? And most of the time I was trying to get something where I was out of fear trying to fix something, trying to make somebody think something different, which is control, control, control. I want to manipulate. I did a lot of that. That was one of my biggest fifth step pattern was approval seeking, which is manipulation, which is pride and ego, which is me trying to be your God. And I don't have to do that anymore. I will still find myself, I'm an alcoholic, and my natural state is to try and do those things if I'm not watching. But by the grace of the steps that I worked with her, I am able to recognize much more quickly when I am being controlling, when I'm trying to manipulate. Like, it is so subtle, so subtle. But anyway, so I did a lot of the meeting before the meeting. On my fifth step, too, I went on a date, and I was told I need to sponsor. So I started sponsoring women after 1 year, even though I wasn't done with my steps. Maybe that got me going a little faster. I don't know. But then it was like, oh, my God, what do I do? What do I say? And she's like, well, you're an alcoholic, and you've been working with me for a year, so just do what you did with me. I was like, so simple, but it was hard because I wanted to control this person that I'm sponsoring, right? I want them to do this and I want them to do that. It wasn't like I was giving them a choice when I circled the meetings we were supposed to go to. Like, from me, it wasn't a suggestion. So, it took a little while, but I did manage to get a couple of sponsees that are still sober today, which I am just, like, amazed. It's not me, it's them. Can tell you that. I was just the example of what it would be like if you keep drinking or don't do the work. So anyways, let's see. I took her suggestions. If you're new and you're not willing to take the suggestions, that's on you. You go out and drink some more. You go out and figure it out till you're desperate enough to take the suggestions, humble enough to take the suggestions, because it's by the grace of God and the actions I've been taking. It's the only reason I'm still sober today. I don't expect my higher power to just make me sober forever. God, that'd be great. Be great. That's all I ever wanted was everything just to be easy. I don't want to be a grown-up. My natural state is childlike. Like, I don't want to pay the bills. I don't want to clean the toilet. I don't want to go to work. I don't want to call my kid. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to call AT&T and yell at them because my internet doesn't work. I don't want to do any of that. I don't want to look at, Medicare and Social Security. I don't want to look at all that. I don't want to make decisions. I want to be a kid. I want you to take care of me. And that's what I was searching for. Like, so many higher powers were men in my life before the one I have now. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for helping me find one that's actually real, that loves me and cares for me and is infallible, that will not fail me as long as I keep an open mind and a willingness to do whatever their plan is, whatever my higher power's plan is, not mine. And that requires a lot of third step trust, right? Get on my knee, I offer myself to thee to build of me, do with me as thou wilt. Well, what if it's something I don't want to do? What if it's a hard conversation with one of my kids? What if I have to quit my job? You know, all of that security. Like, I remember, I don't know about you guys, but back when I went to school, the word insecure was really big. Now it's anxiety, but it was insecurity then. Yeah, they call it anxiety now, but it's, and they treat it with drugs, but I didn't have that benefit. You know, so it isn't hard for me to feel insecure about the future. And that's why this program teaches me to live one day at a time. Stay right here in this moment and don't fight it. Do the next, I was a big, big thing with my sponsor, and she didn't laugh very often, but this one she laughed. I said, so what is God's will for me? And she goes, the next right thing in front of you. It's like so simple. Like, how could that be a thing? Like, what? And so that really took that to heart because I stopped beating myself up for not doing it right, not being enough. And once I started doing the third step prayer and then a little later the seventh step prayer, it's like, okay, I am trusting that you're going to show me what's right and you're going to forgive me if I don't do your plan because I asked. I asked for the words. I asked for the willingness. The self-esteem and the self-worth that changed. I had no self-worth when I got here. All those little actions of driving people to meetings and my sponsor would sit next to me. I finally learned in the first year she would raise my hand, right? She'd be like, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I'm not sitting by you anymore. And, but all of that stuff built my self-worth. I started feeling good about myself. I helped people move. Like, I went to bowling, even though I can't stand bowling. But I went there for the fellowship because it was the right thing to do. I went to apple pie at Applebee's after the meeting, even though it was late and I had to get up at 4:30. I did this stuff that made me feel a part of, and it made me feel like I was loved and worthy. Like I'm doing good things. I'm doing good things. I feel better about myself. Hello? How obvious can that be? Stop stealing, stop cheating, stop lying, stop nickeling, and oh God, you feel better. Go figure. So I will say that, I look back over 21 years and I think there's still so much I had to learn at 10 years sober, at 12 years sober, at 15 years. I was still like, it was like I was working on different compartments of my life. And the first one being like just getting sober. And then it was like family a little bit. And then it was job. And then it was men again. And then it was, and it would just kind of go around and around. And whatever like seemed to be the big deal, I'd be working on with my sponsor and working on, and I just, my result was nil until I let go. Like, let go. So my sponsor asked me, she says, when we're working on forceps, she goes, so I want you to write down your list of things that you want in a man, in a relationship, in a romantic relationship. So I write my list, and I share it with her, and she's like, huh, that's not what I would have had on my list. And I'm like, why? And she goes, well, you got here. He's got to be 6 feet tall. He's got to be thin. He's got to have hair. He's got to have six figures. She says, what about like being kind and having a sense of humor? What about being responsible and reliable and dependable? What about finding funny? What about like liking the same things you like to do? Like, that had never occurred to me because, you see, I was filling a position. I was interviewing, right? That one girlfriend that I met a lot more after that, but that one girlfriend, she said to me, you know, we should sign up for Match.com. So we did. And it was like $30 a month, and I'm making, you know, $30,000 a year, and $30 a month was a lot of money. And although I did learn how to pay my bills in Alcoholics Anonymous the right way. She's like, but you should get at least two or three dates a week from this if you want to get your money's worth. I'm like, all right. That was a challenge. She threw down the glove. And I worked on it, and I got my two or three dates a week, and I had like 90 dates in 60 days. Like, it was crazy. And I'm like, okay, God, I'm tired. But I can tell you what I learned about myself in those freaking 60 days was amazing. Like, I learned that I was trying to fill a position. I learned that I was trying to get something, not bring something. I learned that I was looking way out in the future instead of staying in the moment. I learned that I still had the desire to do risky behaviors that would potentially put my children in risk, put myself at risk. I learned a lot about myself. And if you ever want to do serial dating again, like, you got to tell your sponsor about every date. You got to keep, right? Like, every day I'd be telling them, so here's what's going on. And here's it. That's the deal here. If I'm not accountable, if I'm not talking to my sponsor, if I'm not sharing what I'm doing on a daily basis, I'm not going to get better. And she's the one who said things like, well, what if you got in the car and instead of thinking maybe this is the guy, maybe you said, okay, God, help me not waste this person's time. Help me bring some joy and happiness to this person I'm meeting, no matter what happens. Wow, some kind of altruistic motive. Like, I couldn't on my own come up with that stuff, guys. I don't come from that place. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm selfish, and I'm self-centered to the extreme. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot about dating. I learned a lot about my children. I also went to another program that helped me deal with, having been a child of an alcoholic. I learned how to behave differently to my children from that perspective as well. I did have the blessing of meeting this gentleman, my husband, at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whenever we're asked, where'd you guys meet? We met in a church. You know, I can say that. We met in a church. And makes it sound so holy, doesn't it? You'd never know. But I will say, he was so defeated. And I felt really bad for him. But a couple years later, I'm at the New Year's Eve party asking his sponsor, so is Tom done with the steps yet? No. I'm like, okay. The next year, I asked his sponsor, so is Tom done with the steps yet? No, but he can date. But he's never going to ask you. And I'm like, why not? Well, he's too shy. So I asked him out. But before I asked him out, I called my sponsor and I said, because she knew him too. I mean, everybody knows he had a gigantic group that he went to, so lots of people knew him, but he was a big, strong member of Alcoholics Anonymous by then. And I said, okay, so I want to ask Tom out. What do I do? And she's like, okay, let's get you ready for rejection. If you were thinking about doing something big, get spiritual about it, guys. Go to your sponsor, talk about it. Ask for help. And so I was ready for rejection. We literally wrote the words out for the call. We literally wrote out the words, and I called him up and I read the stuff. And he said, yes. So So we met and had coffee, and then we went grocery shopping. That was our first date. Went to breakfast. Yeah. So I can tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous made me a different person. It made me willing to do things differently. And I'm, if I don't go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I don't call my sponsor, if I don't do my daily prayers and meditations, I know I'm going to revert right back to that selfish, self-centered, angry, unpredictable, unkind person that I was and still am inside. It's in there. I have a disease. It's like diabetes. It's never going away. I am a man who's lost his legs. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine being the person who's lost a leg and how you'd feel? Like, damn it, the rest of my life without legs. That's how I felt about alcohol. It was like that for me. And the self-pity and the rage that I felt. And I have a solution. I'm lucky. I'm grateful. But it's not gonna get better unless I keep coming here. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you, Sherry Lynn. That was awesome. Thank you very much. One more time for Sherry Lynn.